You are listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Mystics After Modernism, Discovering the Seeds of a New Science in the Renaissance. This is section 4 on Cardinal Nicholas of Cusa. Nicholas Cripps of Cusa was a gloriously shining star in the firmament of medieval spiritual life. Footnote: Nicholas of Cusa, 1401 to 1464, German prelate and philosopher, became cardinal in 1448 and bishop of Bresanone in 1450. He wrote on the supremacy of church councils, experimented in botany, collected manuscripts, and discovered the lost comedies of Plautus. Cusa is near Treves, or Trier, Germany, in the Rhineland Palatinate on the Moselle River, about 6 miles from Luxembourg. End of footnote. He stood on the heights of learning during his time. He produced outstanding work in mathematics, and in natural science he may be described as the precursor of Copernicus, for he believed that the earth is a moving heavenly body like others. He had broken with the view that the great astronomer Tycho Brahe still held 100 years later. Footnote: Tycho Brahe, 1546 to 1601, Danish astronomer who helped to establish the Uraniborg Observatory on the island of Hven, now Ven. Johannes Kepler, 1571 to 1630, was his assistant under the patronage of Rudolf II in Bohemia. He proved Nova was a star and believed that the 5 planets revolve around the sun, all of which revolve around the earth, which remains stationary. His observations were published by Kepler in the title Rudolphine Tables. End of footnote. Brahe argued against the teaching of Copernicus by saying, quote, "The earth is a coarse and heavy mass, unsuited for movement. How can Copernicus make a star of it and lead it around in the atmosphere?" Close quote. Footnote from title Opera Omnia, Castle, 1590, end of footnote. Nicholas of Cusa, who did not simply embrace the knowledge of his time, but developed it further, also had an elevated capacity to awaken this knowledge to an inner life. For him, it not only elucidated the external world, but also gained for human beings the spiritual life for which they yearned from the most profound depths of their souls. If we compare Nicholas with such spirits as Eckhart or Tauler, we reach an important conclusion. Nicholas is the scientific thinker whose goal is to rise to a higher view through his research into world phenomena. Eckhart and Tauler are the believing confessors who seek a higher life through the meaning contained in their faith. Nicholas finally reaches the same inner life as Meister Eckhart, but the substance of his inner life is a rich learning process. The full meaning of the difference becomes clear when we consider that for a person who is interested in the various sciences, there is a real danger of misjudging the scope of the paths to knowledge in different fields of learning. Such a person can easily be misled into the belief that there is only one way of knowing, and will then either underestimate or overestimate the paths of knowledge that lead to a goal in matters pertaining to the various sciences. In the one case, people will approach phenomena of the highest spiritual life in the same way as a problem in physics, and deal with them in terms of concepts used to elucidate the forces of gravity and electricity. According to whether such people consider themselves to be more or less enlightened, the world becomes a blindly acting mechanism, an organism, the functional construction of a personal god, or perhaps a structure directed and penetrated by a more or less clearly imagined world soul. In the other case, they notice that the particular knowledge of which they have experience is useful only for the things of the sensory world. Then they become skeptics who might say, quote, "We cannot know anything about what lies beyond the sensory world. Our knowledge has limits. When we aspire to the necessities of higher life, we merely throw ourselves into the arms of a faith, untouched by knowledge. Close quote. For a learned theologian like Nicholas of Cusa, who was at the same time a natural scientist, the second danger was particularly real. In his education, he was a product of scholasticism, the dominant philosophy in the scholarly life of the Church of the Middle Ages, which had been brought to its highest flowering by Thomas Aquinas, the Prince of Scholastics, in quotes. This philosophy must be used as a background if one wants to depict the personality of Nicholas of Cusa. Scholasticism, to a great degree, is a product of human ingenuity. In scholasticism, the logical faculty celebrated its greatest triumphs. One who aims to elaborate concepts in their sharpest and clearest contours should serve an apprenticeship with the scholastics. It is they who provide the best training for the technique of thinking. They had an incomparable agility in the field of pure thought. It is easy to underestimate what they were capable of accomplishing in this field. In most areas of learning, agility in the realm of thought is accessible to the human being only with difficulty. Most people attain it clearly only in the areas of counting and calculating, arithmetic, and in considering the properties of geometric forms. We can count by adding a unit to a number in our thoughts without calling sensory images to our help. We also calculate without such images in the pure element of thought alone. As for geometric forms, we know that they do not completely coincide with any sensory image. In the reality of the senses, there exists no conceptual circle, and yet our thinking occupies itself with this circle. It is more difficult to find conceptual counterparts for objects and processes that are more complicated than numerical and spatial structures. This difficulty has led to the claim in various fields of investigation that real knowledge is represented only by that which can be measured and counted. This is decidedly wrong, in that it is one-sided, but it seduces many as often only one-sided ideas can. The truth is that most people are not capable of grasping the purely conceptual when it is no longer a matter of measuring and counting. But someone who cannot grasp the higher realms of life and knowledge resembles a child who has not yet learned to count in any other way than by adding one P to another. The thinker who said that there is as much true knowledge in any field of learning as there is mathematics in it did not grasp the full truth of the matter. We must require that everything that cannot be measured and counted be treated in the same conceptual fashion as numerical and spatial structures. And this requirement was greatly respected by the scholastics. Everywhere they sought the conceptual content of things, just as the mathematician seeks it in measuring and counting. In spite of this accomplished logical skill, the scholastics attained only a one-sided and subordinate concept of cognition. According to this concept, in the process of cognition, the human being produces an image of what is to be grasped. It is quite obvious that with such a concept of cognition, one must place all reality outside cognition. In the process of cognition, one cannot grasp a thing itself, but only an image of this thing. People also cannot grasp themselves in self-knowledge. What they grasp is only an image of the self. It is quite in the spirit of scholasticism that someone who is closely acquainted with it says, quote, "In time, people have no perception of the self, the hidden foundation of spiritual nature and life. They will never be able to look at themselves. Forever estranged from God, they find in themselves only a bottomless dark abyss and endless emptiness. Or else, blessed in God and turning their gaze inward, people find only God, whose sun of grace shines within, and whose image is reflected in the spiritual traits of their nature." Close quote. Footnote: Karl Werner, title Franz Suarez und die Scholastik der letzten Jahrhunderte, Francisco Suarez and the Scholasticism of the Last Centuries, page 122, sorry for my German, end of footnote. Someone who thinks about all-knowing in this way has a concept of such knowledge that applies only to the external world. The sensory aspects of reality always remain external to us. We can receive into our perception only sensory images of the world. When we perceive a color or a stone, we ourselves cannot become color or stone in order to know the nature of color or stone. Neither can the color or the stone transform itself into a part of our own nature. Focused as it is on the outer, is a concept of this form of knowledge exhaustive? Is it true that for scholasticism all human cognition coincides essentially with this form of cognition? Another writer who is familiar with scholasticism characterizes the concept of cognition of that philosophy this way, quote, "Our spirit, in that it is associated with the body in earthly life, is primarily directed toward the surrounding world of matter. But it focuses on spirit in the world, that is, the essences, natures, and forms of things, the elements of existence that are akin to it, and provide it with the rungs by which it ascends to the suprasensory. The field of our cognition is the realm of experience, but we should learn to understand what it offers, penetrate to its sense and idea, and thereby open to ourselves the world of ideas." Close quote. Footnote, Otto Willmann, title Geschichte des Idealismus, History of Idealism, Volume 2, 2nd edition, page 396, end of footnote. Scholastics could not attain a different concept of cognition. They were prevented from doing so by the dogmatic teaching of their theology. If they had fixed their spiritual gaze upon what to them was a mere image, they would have observed that the spiritual meaning of things reveals itself in this so-called image. They would then have found that God is not merely mirrored within human beings, but that he lives in them. He is present in the human essence. In looking within, they would not have stared at a dark abyss of endless emptiness, or at a mere image of God. Instead, they would have felt that divine life itself vibrates within the human being, and that their own lives are one with the life of God. Scholastics could not acknowledge this. In their opinion, God could not enter the human being and speak from an individual. He could exist there only as an image. In reality, it had to be assumed that divinity exists outside the self. God must reveal himself through supranatural communications from outside, and cannot do so within, through the spiritual life. It is precisely this kind of thinking that is least likely to achieve the intended result, that is, the most sublime concept of divinity. But this kind of thinking reduces divinity to a thing among other things. Aspects of the world reveal themselves to the human being through experience, while God is thought to reveal himself in a supernatural way. One proposes a difference between the perception of divinity and of creation in saying that, with respect to creation, external reality is given in the experience, that one has knowledge of it. The experience of divinity does not produce an object. One can attain this only through faith. To scholastics, the highest ideas are not objects of knowledge. They are objects of faith alone. It is true that according to the scholastic view, the relationship of knowledge to faith is not to be imagined in such a way that in a certain field only knowledge predominates, and in another only faith. Quote, "Cognition of what exists is possible for us, because it originates in a creative insight. Things are for spirit, because they are from spirit. They tell us something because they receive their meaning from a higher intelligence. Close quote, footnote. From O. Willmann, Titelgeschichte des Idealismus, History of Idealism, and end of footnote. Since God has created the world according to His ideas, when we grasp the ideas of the world, we can also grasp the traces of divinity in the world through scientific reflection. But we can know the nature of God in His essence only through supranatural revelation, which requires our belief. Our thoughts about the highest ideas are not decided by any human knowledge, but by faith. And, quote, to faith belongs everything contained in the scriptures of the New and Old Covenant and in the divine traditions, close quote. Footnote from Josef Kloetgen, titled Die Theologie der Vorfit, The Theology of Antiquity, Volume 1, page 39, end of footnote. We cannot assume the task here of a detailed description and an explanation of the relationship between the meaning of faith and that of knowledge. Indeed, the essence of all faith originates in inner human experience. It is preserved according to its external worth, with no consciousness of how it was acquired. It is said that it came into the world through supernatural revelation. The essence of the Christian faith was simply accepted as tradition by the scholastics. Science and inner experience were not allowed to claim any rights over it. Scholastics could no more permit themselves to create a concept of God than scientists can create a tree. They had to accept the revealed concept as given, just as natural scientists accept the tree as given. Scholastics could never admit that spirit itself shines and lives within human beings. Consequently, they established a boundary for the jurisdiction of science at the point where the area of outer experience ends. Human cognition could not be permitted to produce a concept of the higher entities. Human beings were to accept a revealed one. The scholastics could not concede that by accepting this concept, they in fact embraced an idea that had been produced at an earlier stage of human spiritual life and declared to be a revelation. In the course of the development of scholasticism, all those ideas disappeared from it that still indicated the way human beings arrive at concepts of divinity in a natural way. During the first centuries of the development of Christianity, at the time of the Church Fathers, we see how the teachings of theology came into being little by little through the inclusion of inner experiences. This is still treated entirely as an inner experience by John Scotus Erigena, who stood at the height of Christian theological learning in the 9th century. Footnote, John Scotus Erigena, 810 to 877, theologian and philosopher from Ireland, was invited to teach at the court of Charles II near Laon and to assist Hincmar of Reims in the controversy over predestination. Later he was condemned by the Council of Valencia, 855. He translated into Latin and commented on the works of Pseudo-Dionysius the Areopagite, St. Maximus the Confessor, St. Gregory of Nyssa, and St. Epiphanius. He tried to reconcile Neoplatonist emanationism and Christian creationism. Pope Honorius II condemned his work, 1225, as pantheistic. End of footnote. Among the scholastics of the succeeding centuries, this quality of an inner experience is completely lost. The old meaning is reinterpreted as an external, supranatural revelation. One can interpret the activity of the mystical theologians Eckhart, Tauler, Zuso, and their companions by saying that they were inspired by the teachings of the Church, as contained in theology, but reinterpreted, to reproduce a similar meaning from themselves as an inner experience. Nicholas of Cusa began the task of ascending independently to inner experiences from the knowledge one acquires in the various sciences. There can be no doubt that the excellent technique of logic that the scholastics had developed, and in which Nicholas had been educated, furnished a superb means of attaining inner experiences, even though the scholastics themselves were kept from this road by their positive faith. But one will fully understand Nicholas only by realizing that his vocation as priest, which raised him to the position of cardinal, prevented him from breaking completely with the faith of the Church, whose contemporary expression was found in scholastic theology. We find him so far advanced along a certain path that every step would have led him, of necessity, out of the Church. Consequently, we understand the cardinal best if we complete that step that he did not take, and then, in retrospect, illuminate what had been his intention. The most important concept of the spiritual life of Nicholas is that of, quote, learned ignorance, close quote. By learned ignorance, he means a higher form of cognition than is represented by ordinary knowledge. Knowledge, in the lower sense, means that spirit comprehends an object. The most important characteristic of knowledge is that it gives information about an entity outside spirit. That is, knowledge looks at something that spirit itself is not. In knowledge, the spirit is occupied with matters considered to be outside it. But what the spirit forms in itself concerning objects of the outer world is their essence. Things are spirit. At first, the human being sees the spirit only through the sensory covering. What remains outside the spirit is only this sensory covering. The essence of things enters into the spirit. When spirit views this essence, which is substance of its substance, it can no longer speak of knowledge. It does not observe an object outside. It looks upon a thing that is part of itself. It looks at itself. It no longer knows. It only observes itself. It is not concerned with knowing, but with not knowing. It no longer takes hold of the world through spirit. It beholds without grasping its own life. The highest level of cognition, in relation to the lower levels, is not knowing. The essence of things can be communicated only at this level of perception. With his, quote, learned not knowing, close quote, Nicholas of Cusa speaks only of knowledge reborn as inner experience. He himself tells how he came to have this inner experience, quote, I made many attempts to unite my thoughts about God and the world, about Christ and the Church, in one fundamental idea, but none satisfied me, until finally, during my return from Greece by sea, the gaze of my spirit lifted, as if through an inspiration from on high, to the view in which God appeared to me as the highest unity of all contrasts. Close quote. Footnote. Letter from the author to Cardinal Julianus at the end of the De Docta Ignorantia, Volume 3. End of footnote. Nicholas's predecessors more or less played a role in this inspiration. In his mode of thinking, we recognize a peculiar renewal of the ideas encountered in the writings of a certain Dionysius. John Scotus Origena, mentioned earlier, translated that work into Latin. He called the author the great and divine revealer. Footnote, Dionysius the Areopagite, circa AD 500, an author whose identity is considered a mystery. He is thought to have originated in Syria and has been considered to be a convert of St. Paul. His primary works are titled The Celestial Hierarchy and titled The Divine Names. End of footnote. These writings first came to light in the first half of the 6th century. They were ascribed to Dionysius the Areopagite, who was mentioned in the Acts of the Apostles and was converted to Christianity by Paul. We shall not go into the question of when these writings were really composed. Their essence had a strong effect on Nicholas, as they had on John Scotus Origena. In many respects, they also stimulated the way of thinking of Eckhart and his companions. The, quote, learned not knowing, close quote, is prefigured in a certain way in these writings. Here we shall record only the main characteristic of the thinking inherent in these writings. People learn first about the things of the sensory realm. They reflect on the existence and activity of this world. The primordial foundation of all things must exist in a higher realm than the things themselves. People, therefore, cannot expect to comprehend that primordial foundation with the same concepts and ideas with which they grasp the things themselves. If people attribute to the primordial foundation, God, qualities they are familiar with from the lower realm, such qualities can be merely auxiliary ideas of the weak spirit, which draws the primordial foundation down to itself so that people can imagine it. In fact, no quality that lower phenomena possess can be said to belong to God. It cannot even be said that God exists. Being, in quotes, too, is a concept that human beings have formed in connection with lower phenomena. But God is exalted above being and not being. Consequently, the God to whom we ascribe qualities is not the true one. We arrive at the true God if we imagine a, quote, supra-God, close quote, above a God with those qualities. We can know nothing of this supra-God in the ordinary sense. To reach such a God, knowing must flow into unknowing. One can see that such a view is based on the awareness that human beings themselves can, in a purely natural way, develop a higher form of cognition from the knowledge provided by the sciences. This perception is no longer mere knowledge. The scholastic view declared that knowledge lacks the capacity for such development. And at the point where knowledge is supposed to end, it claimed faith, based on external revelation as the aid of knowledge. Nicholas of Cusa was on the way toward, once again, developing knowledge in a way that the scholastics had declared impossible. From the point of view of Nicholas of Cusa, one cannot say that there is only one kind of knowing. On the contrary, cognition is clearly divided into the medium for knowing external reality and the object itself of such knowledge. The former kind of apprehension predominates in the sciences, as the knowledge we acquire about the objects and processes of the sensory world. This kind of perception is active when we ourselves live in the knowledge that has been acquired. The second kind of comprehension develops from the first. Yet it is the same world to which both kinds of cognition refer, and it is the same human being who partakes of both. The question must follow: how does it happen that one and the same person develops two kinds of perception of one and the same world? The direction in which we must search for the answer was indicated in our discussion of Tauler. This answer can be even further defined with regard to Nicholas of Cusa. First, the human being lives as a separate individual being among other separate beings. In addition to the influences that other beings exercise upon one another, the faculty of lower cognition is found in the individual human being. Through the senses, we receive impressions of other beings and work on those impressions with our spiritual faculties. We direct our spiritual gaze from external things and look at ourselves, at our own activity. In this way, self-knowledge arises within us. As long as we remain at this level of self-knowledge, we do not yet see ourselves in the true sense of the word. We can maintain the belief that there is some hidden entity at work within us, and that what appears to us as our own activity is merely the manifestation and action of the other entity. The moment may come when people understand, through an indisputable inner experience, that what they perceive and encounter within themselves is not the manifestation or activity of a hidden force or entity, but instead that entity itself in its primordial form. Such a person may then say, quote, "All other things I encounter as given, in a sense, and I, standing outside them, add to them what Spirit has to say about them. But I live through creatively adding to things in myself, and I discover what I am. I find my own essence." Close quote. What is speaking in the depths of my spirit? It is knowledge that speaks, the knowledge I have acquired about the things of the world. It is not an action or manifestation that speaks. The source of that speaking holds back none of its essence. In this knowledge, the world speaks in all its immediacy. But I have acquired this knowledge from phenomena and from myself, as a being among other beings. Out of my own essence, I myself and world phenomena speak. I no longer express merely my own nature. I express the nature of things. My I-being is the form, the means, through which things declare themselves. I have come to know that I experience my own essence within myself. For me, this experience becomes enlarged into another. In me and through me, universal essence expresses itself, or in other words, knows itself. Now I can no longer feel that I am merely a thing among things. I can sense that I am a form in which universal essence has its life. Consequently, it is only natural that one and the same person should have two kinds of cognition. With regard to sensory facts, the human being is of the world. Insofar as this is the case, people come to know things of the world, but at any moment they can have the higher experience that they are the form in which the universal essence sees itself. Then they themselves are transformed from an entity among other entities into a form of the universal essence. And with them the knowledge of things is changed into an expression of the nature of things. This transformation, however, can be accomplished only by human beings themselves. The object of higher cognition is not present until higher perception itself is present. Only by manifesting a more advanced awareness can human beings develop their nature, and only through higher cognition can the nature of phenomena come into existence. If people are not allowed to add anything to sensory perception through higher cognition, but express only what exists as given by the outside world, this really means renouncing all higher cognition. With regard to sensory life, human beings are entities among other entities, and attain higher cognition only when, as sensory beings, they transform themselves into higher beings. It follows that they can never replace one cognition with the other. Rather, spiritual life is made up of a perpetual back-and-forth movement between two poles of cognition, between knowing and seeing. If people were to shut themselves off from seeing, they would forego the nature of things. If they were to shut themselves off from sensory knowing, they would deprive themselves of the things whose nature they want to understand. The same things reveal themselves to the lower understanding and to the higher seeing, but at one time in terms of external appearance, and another time with regard to inner essence. It is not inherent to the nature of things that they appear only as external objects at a certain stage. Rather, this happens because people must first transform themselves to the point where the things of the world cease to have only an external reality. It is only with these considerations in mind that certain views elaborated by natural science during the 19th century appear in their proper light. Adherents of those views would say, quote, "We hear, see, and touch the things of the material world through the senses. The eye, for example, communicates a light phenomenon, a color. We say that a body gives off red light when, through the medium of our eyes, we experience the sensation," in quotes, "red. But in other cases, the eye gives us another sensation. If the eye is struck or pressed, or if an electric current passes through the head, the eye experiences a sensation of light. When we have the sensation that a body gives off a certain color of light, something may be happening in that body that does not in any way resemble color. Regardless of what is occurring in the outer world, as long as the process can make an impression upon the eye, a sensation of color arises. Our perception arises in us because our organs are constituted in a certain way. Occurrences in the outer world remain outside us. We know only the effects that external processes produce within us." Reader aside, that last section I started with a quote, but there was no close quote, so I believe that that close quote ended a bit sooner, and most of that was Steiner. Apologize. End of reader's aside. Hermann Helmholtz, 1821 to 1894, expressed this idea in a clearly defined way. Quote, "Our perceptions are effects produced in our organs by external causes. The way those effects manifest depends substantially on the kind of apparatus they work on. Insofar as the quality of our perception provides information that characterizes the external influence that created it, one may consider it to be an indication of the influence, but not a representation of it. We require an image to be somewhat similar to the object represented. We likewise require similarity of form in a statue, a similarity of perspective in the field of view of drawing, and, in addition to the perspective, a similarity of color in a painting. But a sign needs no resemblance to the external object. The relationship between the two is limited. The same object, given the same circumstances, must evoke the same sign. Accordingly, unlike signs always correspond to unlike influences. If in the course of ripening, berries of a certain variety develop both a red pigment and sugar, then red color and sweet taste will always be found together in our perception of berries of this kind." Close quote. Footnote: Hermann Helmholtz, title Die Tatsachen der Wahrnehmung, The Facts of Perception, page 12 and forward, end of footnote. I have described in detail this kind of thinking in title Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, a Philosophy of Freedom, and in title Riddles of Philosophy. Now, let us follow step by step the train of thought adopted by this view. A process is assumed to occur in the outer world. It produces an effect on my sensory organ. My nervous system transmits the resulting impression to my brain, and another process is produced there. I now perceive, in quotes, red. It is said that, therefore, the perception of the color red is not outside me, but within me. All our perceptions are only signs of external processes, the true nature of which we know nothing. We live and act among our perceptions and know nothing of their origin. In line with this way of thinking, we can also say that if we had no eyes, there would be no color. Nothing would then transform the external process, which is unknown to us, into the perception red. This train of thought is seductive to many people. Nevertheless, it is based on a complete misinterpretation of the facts under consideration. If many contemporary natural scientists and philosophers were not seriously deluded by this way of thinking, we would not need to speak about it so much. But this delusion has in fact corrupted contemporary thinking in many ways. Because we are entities among other entities, the things of the world must make an impression upon us if we are to discover anything about them. A process outside the human being must give lead to a process within us if red is to appear in the field of our vision. One must only ask, what is outside and what is inside? Outside is a process in space and time. But inside there is certainly a similar process. Such a process exists in the eye and communicates itself to the brain when I perceive red. I cannot directly observe the process that takes place inside any more than I can directly perceive in the outer world the motion of light waves, which physicists believe corresponds to the color red. It is only in this sense, however, that I can speak of outer and inner qualities. Only in terms of sensory perception does the differentiation between outside and inside have any validity. This perception leads me to assume a process of space-time in the outer world, though I cannot perceive it directly. Moreover, that same perception leads me to assume such a process exists within me, which I am also unable to perceive directly. But I also assume other spatio-temporal processes in ordinary life, which I cannot perceive directly. For example, I hear a piano played in the next room and assume that a human being having spatial dimensions sits at the piano and plays. My way of representing matters to myself is the same, whether I speak of processes within me or outside me. I assume that the characteristics of such processes are analogous to qualities of those processes perceived by my senses, but that for certain reasons they are inaccessible to my direct observation. If I were to deny that these processes involve all the qualities my senses reveal to me in the realm of space and time, it would be like the proverbial knife without a handle whose blade is missing. I can say only that spatio-temporal processes take place in the outer world, and that they give rise to spatio-temporal processes within. Both are necessary if red is to appear in my field of vision. Insofar as it is not spatio-temporal, it would be useless to look for this red, whether outside or inside. If natural scientists and philosophers cannot find red in the outer world, neither should they attempt to look for it within. It is not inside in the same sense that it is not outside. To say that everything the sensory world presents to us is really an inner world of perceptions, and to look for something external that corresponds to it, is an impossible concept. Consequently, we cannot say that red, sweet, hot, and so on are indications to which something very different in the outer world corresponds, and that as such they arise only within us. In fact, the effect produced within us, as the result of an external process, is quite different from what appears in the field of our perception. If we want to refer to what arises in us as signs, we can say that those signs appear within our organism as a way to communicate perceptions that in their immediacy are neither inside nor outside us. Rather, they belong to that common world of which my external world and my interior world are only parts. It is true that if I wish to grasp that common realm, I must rise to the higher level of cognition that recognizes neither inside nor outside. I am well aware that those who rely on the truism that our entire world of experience is made up of sensations of unknown origin will look down their noses at this exposition, Their view of it will be somewhat like that of Dr. Erich Adikes, who, in his work titled Kant contra Haeckel, Berlin 1901, says condescendingly, quote, "For the time being, people like Haeckel and thousands of his kind philosophize merrily away, completely unconcerned with theories of cognition or with critical introspection," close quote, page 120. Footnote, Ernst Haeckel, 1834 to 1919, German philosopher and biologist. He was the first German to advocate Darwin's theory of evolution. He formulated the familiar biological dictum, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. End of footnote. Such gentlemen have no idea of the insignificance of their own theories of cognition. They suspect a lack of critical introspection only in others. We shall not begrudge them their, in quotes, wisdom. Nicholas of Cusa has excellent ideas on exactly the point we are considering. He maintains a clear separation between the lower and higher forms of cognition. Consequently, on the one hand, he can gain extensive insight into the fact that people as sensory beings experience within themselves only those processes that, as effects, must be unlike the corresponding external processes. On the other hand, the differentiation of types of cognition keeps him from confusing those inner processes with the realities that appear in our field of perception, and that in their immediacy are neither outside nor inside, but are elevated above such disparity. Nicholas was, quote, "prevented by his priestly cloth," close quote, from following, without reservations, the path that this insight indicated to him. We see him making a good beginning with the advance from knowing to not knowing. But at the same time, we must note that in the field of not knowing, he has nothing to impart except the theological teachings offered to us by scholasticism. It is true that he knows how to develop this theology in an ingenious way. His teachings on providence, Christ, the creation, the redemption, and the moral life are completely in harmony with Christian dogma. In keeping with his spiritual direction, he might have said, quote, "I am confident that human nature, having immersed itself in every science, can transform from within itself knowing into unknowing, and that consequently the highest cognition brings satisfaction," close quote. In this case, he would have rejected, which he did not, the traditional ideas of soul, immortality, redemption, God, creation, the Trinity, and so on, and would have upheld those that he himself had discovered. Nicholas, however, was so immersed in Christian concepts that he could easily believe he was awakening his own proper inner unknowing, whereas he was, in fact, merely presenting the traditional views of his education. We must remember that he was standing before a fateful abyss in human spiritual life. He was a man of science, which initially removes people from their innocent concord with the world, which exists as long as they conduct their lives in a purely naive way. While living such a life, people have a dim sense of their connection to the universe as a whole. They, like other beings, are integrated into the chain of natural effects. With knowledge, they separate themselves from the whole, thus creating a spiritual world within. Within this world, people confront nature in solitude. They have become richer, but this wealth is a difficult burden, initially weighing on each individual alone. People must find the way back to nature through their own resources. They must understand that now they themselves must integrate their wealth into the chain of universal effects, just as nature integrated their poverty previously. It is here that all the evil demons lie in wait for human beings, whose strength can easily fail. Instead of accomplishing that integration themselves, people take refuge in revelation from outside, which delivers them from solitude and directs the knowledge they experience as a burden back to the primordial origin of existence. Divinity. They will think, as did Nicholas of Cusa, that they are walking of their own road, while in reality they find only the road their spiritual development has shown them. In general, there are three paths upon which one can walk once one arrives at the point Nicholas had reached. One is positive faith, which comes to us from outside. The second is despair, when one stands alone with one's burden and feels all existence shattered with oneself. The third path is the self-development of one's deepest faculties. One necessary quality that leads one along this third path is confidence in the world, and the other is the courage to follow that confidence, no matter where it leads. Addendum 1923. In a few words, I hint here at the path to the cognition of spirit I described in my later writings, especially in title How to Know Higher Worlds, title An Outline of Esoteric Science, and title Riddles of the Soul. And that's the end of this section.